We have been exploring over the last couple of weeks some of the extraordinary brilliance of Jesus' teaching on third-way thinking. And I mentioned when I introduced this that third-way thinking is not a new idea, of course, and not original to Jesus, older than Jesus in terms of its history from the Western understanding of that way of looking at problems. Probably the most obvious attribution is actually to the Buddha, so predates Christ by, I guess, at least 600 years or so, historically. But this idea that when we are facing injustice or conflict or dilemmas, that our tendency to default to either despair or passivity on the one hand, or retribution or violence of like kind or injury of like kind on the other, that there needs to be another way to come at those things if that's something good is going to happen. So we've been sort of exploring some of the ideas about that, and ideas are something that I find fascinating and satisfying. They sort of fill me up. It's a very positive experience for me to work with ideas. I can also see a couple of ways that's a problem. And the first is that that's not necessarily a shared experience. Not everyone feels that way about ideas. And that's a problem because ideas are mostly useless unless they can be shared. We're just not isolated beings. We don't do well when we isolate from one another. And the second reason that can be a problem is that I think unless ideas lead to action, not much changes in the world. And it's rather obvious, I would say, that some things need to change in the world. So these wisdom of Jesus stories that we've been looking at for the last couple of weeks, they're all super practical. And in fact, as we've been looking at them, they've all kind of boiled down to basically one-liners, like these very pragmatic, hands-on illustrations of deep life-changing insights about how to radically undermine our not helpful tendencies to default to either that passivity and despair or to violence in kind. And to do that, not just when we're wronged personally, but when we find ourselves operating in a world where things are out of whack or unjust, or even considering, as Tim reminded us this morning, even considering one, a world like that where things are out of whack or unjust. And at the end of our time together last week, I made an attempt to connect some of those ideas to a real-time contemporary example, and we kind of plugged them into some things around the Kavanaugh inquiry. My hope in doing that was to begin to move us from an idea space into a lived life or practiced sort of space, a place where we live differently, to stir our own imaginations about what it might look like for us to live in a third way when it comes to conflict or to change or to dealing with issues around justice and equality and equity and so on. And I basically want to stay on that trajectory this morning, but I want to add to it the opportunity for us during our time together this morning to get our own imaginations into gear about situations in our own lives right now where we can see that that kind of wisdom is needed and needs to be applied. No one's going to be compelled to share anything they don't want to. Personal stories are not going to become public stories in this exercise unless you wish them to be. I want us to do that work, but I also want the table to be a place where it's safe to explore. So do not fear. I want to introduce you to a couple of people or groups of people that have sort of rattled my cage on this stuff in the last few months. First of all, sort of a global rock star theologian that's been at work on some of these things for years, but that I hadn't heard of until recently. Some of you may have, and in which case you can just shake your head knowingly while I reveal my lack of breadth. But this guy's name is Hans, and the last name is spelled K-U-N-G. He's a Swiss Catholic priest and theologian, so his name is actually, I understand, pronounced Kin or Kine, but it's like K-Y-N, but it's K-U-N-G, so if you're looking him up, Hans Kine. He became a Catholic priest when he was quite young. He was in his mid-20s, and he became a professor of theology at Tuttingen University in Germany when he was 31. So, like, right from go, this guy seemed to have some horsepower as a thinker, and he's had this remarkable career as a theologian and as an author, and also as a world-class humanitarian. He's much published. I think he's written about 70 books. It covered lots of ground over the years. Now, he's about 90 years old at this point. He's still making some waves. Not done yet, apparently. Both his Catholicism and his priesthood have been made more complicated by his progressive theology. So This is a guy who, long time ago already, the Catholic Church barred him from officially teaching Catholic theology. They didn't remove his priesthood, but they barred him from teaching theology. Now, that might have something to do with the fact that early on he rejected the doctrine of papal infallibility. So he kind of was in trouble with the Pope right from go. This is also a guy who has argued in favor of gay relationships. He's lobbied on behalf of women being in the Catholic priesthood. He has stated very clearly that if Jesus of Nazareth were to return today, he would welcome divorcees into the church. It's something that might not feel especially radical in this context, but in his context it was. He's also described the Vatican's historic prohibition on birth control as pernicious. Encouraged Catholic parishes to keep their priests after they marry, even though the church declares that they're no longer priests, and so on. So there's just sort of a, you know, high points of Hans Kein's, you know, keeping his elbows up about change within his own denominational context. Shortly after 9/11, Kein addressed the UN General Assembly, and he addressed them on the matter of the future of international relations. And he kind of got to do that because he was part of a 20-person, what was called a group of eminent persons that Kofi Annan, who was then heading the UN, assembled right around that time. And so that's sort of a warm-up. Like, this guy has just covered a lot of ground when it comes to thinking big and not being silent about it. And in particular, Kein is known for his work on what is being called a global ethic. And basically, this is working toward the creation of a consensus among the world's religions on a set of shared ethical values, standards, and attitudes. He puts it this way. He describes that work like this. He says, "We must learn to live together peacefully and share responsibility in caring for the earth and for each other. We need a basic moral code, a global ethic." It's an interesting idea. And it gets more interesting, at least to me, because Kein does not see this as an exclusively religious affair. In fact, quite the opposite. But he does believe that religions have to lead the way in a task like that, not least of all because religions play such a significant role in so many of the world's conflicts and problems. Fair enough. And he puts that perspective like this. Kein says, "No peace among the nations without peace among the religions." The story from Pakistan, it's in the news cycle today about the Christian who blasphemed and is slated for execution and has now been forgiven of that sentence, but the hardliners, Islamist hardliners, still want her dead, but now they're asking for asylum in North America, etc. So that was a news item this morning, last night. And I'm not saying that to comment on hardline Islamists at all, but it's illustrative of the ways in which religion contributes to conflicts. No peace among the nations without peace among the religions, no peace among the religions without dialogue between the religions. So that's how Kein kind of sums that up. Way back in 1993, Kein helped to provide leadership to a process at something called the Parliament of World Religions in Chicago, at which over 200 leaders from over 40 different faith traditions, just that made me want to be there. Anyway, over 200 leaders from over 40 different faith traditions signed a draft document, which Kein was the author of, called A Declaration Toward a Global Ethic. Now, I'm taking up our collective time with this morning because I think it helps to illustrate the good work that can be done if we choose to work together, even in the middle of situations that might sort of categorically be understood to not be tilted that way. And what can happen if we can knock ourselves out of this sort of my way or the highway kind of thinking and look for third way kinds of thinking in the middle of potentially conflicted and difficult situations. Kein's document, this Declaration Toward a Global Ethic, Kein's document calls upon every person, institution, and nation to take responsibility for creating four things. You'll recognize, if you've grown up in and around Christian theology, you'll recognize his own historic framework in this, but not in a way that excludes. Four things: a culture of nonviolence and respect for all life. Quote, "Do not murder." A culture of solidarity and a just economic order. Do not steal. A culture of tolerance and a life of truthfulness. Do not lie. A culture of equal rights and partnership between men and women. Do not misuse sexuality. And the real distinction, as Kind sees it, is not between people that are religious and people that are not religious. The real distinction is between people that practice compassion and empathy and those that give in to a culture of greed, selfishness, and inhumanity, what you were talking about, Ray. It's not your beliefs versus my beliefs, it's what do we have in common. And I wanted to cite all of that and expand it a little bit for us because I think it's an extraordinary example on a global scale of third-way thinking plugged into substantial real-life issues. So, that's kind of awesome if you work for the UN or you're a global rock star theologian. That's nice. And we could come up with other reasons to be dismissive or at least kind of disinterested in that kind of work. I mean, it's ancient, for instance. The 90s are not just so yesterday, they're so last millennium, so we could just, you know, whatever. We can find a way to run around that if we want. So what I want to do is move it forward a bit and closer to home as well. Sometimes we have to go backwards to go forward, so just stay with me because we're not going to start right now with this idea. So in 1934 in Germany, there was a you know now well-known crisis for the planet and for the humans on it because as a species we were facing the tyranny and visible evil of, at that point historically, of Nazism. And what happened in Germany in 1934 is that the state Christian Church of Germany, the Lutheran, German Lutheran Church, as it happens, that's not a pertinent detail, but it's a specificity. The state Christian Church of Germany affirmed the actions and leaderships of that nation at that point. And with the lens of history, looking at this story, I think you could fairly say that the reason they did that was to ensure the place of relative privilege that they enjoyed as an institution in that society at that time. And there were a number of people, most notably Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who at that point drafted something called the Barman Declaration, a statement of held in common values and commitments. Now, I know that this story is made even more kind of complex by the fact that the values in that statement hewed closely to a commitment to nonviolent resistance, and Bonhoeffer was arrested for plotting to assassinate Hitler. It's okay to appreciate these ironies. And I wanted to acknowledge that complexity. I'm not going to address it in any way this morning, but I think the tension needs to be, you know, visible in this stuff. Partly because I think we can all imagine, and some of us might know by experience, that nonviolent action in the face of violent injustice is complex. It just is. And it will not become something other than that, ever. And that's one of the reasons that we need to keep our imagination stirred about how it might be practiced, and it's also why we need to practice in the microclimates of our everyday lives, as well as wondering how these things might be practiced at a national level or at a global level. It really is, practicing these things in our own lives is really running drills. Like it really is about learning how to have a part of our imagination be awake and alive and enabled and robust when we're wrestling with what do you do about country X and global injustice Y? Well, what did you do at home? You know, they do actually apply to one another. So, in any case, here's the today part. And I don't feel apologetic about this detail that I'm about to share, but it is important. The source for all this stuff that I'm going to give us as a framework for our personal work is from the U.S., because that's where the group of people who are doing it are. And so there will be some specific references to American particularities in here that you might feel are not especially applicable to you or to us as Canadians. That's fine. You also won't find the details of this when I put them on the screen in a few moments all equally applicable. Also fine. So I just wanted to acknowledge those things so we don't feel like we have to kind of drag something kicking and screaming into our situation. It's about stirring something in us. It's about getting our imaginations going. So there's this growing consensus among more than, you know, a few Americans in particular that that some parallels could reasonably be drawn between that situation in Germany and the situation in contemporary America. And that has led to the updating of that document that Bonhoeffer and his collaborators drafted in 1934, the Barman Declaration. And it's also led to a movement to make people aware of that document's existence in the interest of galvanizing both contemplation and action against injustice of many kinds. So what we're going to do in a few moments is we're going to put the four statements that are at the center of that declaration onto the screen one by one for our consideration. And we're going to do that to give us a chance to think about our own lives and circumstances and to contemplate what nonviolent, creative, third-way action against injustice might look like for us. I find it almost poetic that this morning, and I've been kind of aiming at this for a while, but this morning when we share space with our First Nations kindred and perhaps experience some of that as an inconvenience, is also the morning when we're engaging in some of this kind of imaginative work. I think there's something quite lovely about that. One final thing before I read us the preface and put up the statements themselves. One of the signatories to this declaration, and I think there are now over 5,000, is Richard Rohr. How many of you is Richard Rohr a familiar name, just by way of curiosity? Okay, I thought there might be a few. Well, Rohr is a Franciscan. Many of you, or at least the people who put up your hands, have probably read Rohr or listened to him over the years. And I feel like I've come to know him as a thoughtful, insightful leader of positive spiritual and cultural change within the Christian tradition, his tradition. Rohr is also, among other things, the founder of the Center for Action and Contemplation in the U.S., and he references that institution in what I'm about to read you. So this is very current. This is a letter from Richard Rohr from October of this year regarding the Barman Declaration and the Center for Action and Contemplation's engagement with it. So Rohr writes, "The most important word in our center's name is not action, nor is it contemplation, but the word and. If your spiritual practice doesn't lead you to some acts of concrete caring or service, then you have every reason not to trust it." While many argue that spiritual teachers shouldn't get involved in politics, even the Hebrew prophets and Jesus critiqued their leaders and practiced civil disobedience, precisely the stories of Jesus that we've been talking about the last 2 weeks. There is no such thing as being non-political. So, I encourage you to practice a contemplative, compassionate politics. The Barman Today Declaration is one way to do just that. He goes on to say, with over 3,000 signatories, that was at that point, we commit to nonviolently reject and resist the marginalization of any color, class, race, religion, disability, gender, or sexual orientation. We reject and resist words, policies, and actions of exclusion, denigration, and nationalism. We reject and resist that which threatens the health and resilience of creation. So that's a pretty good setup for what the Barman folks have to say. So this is from the group of people behind the contemporary version of the Barman Declaration. In contemporary America, we face parallel threats, and they're paralleling that to the 1930s story in Germany that I was telling you. We face parallel threats and affirmations as prominent and privileged leaders of America's Christian churches choose to closely and publicly support the policies and actions of our nation's leadership, policies and actions irreconcilable with the pursuit of peace and justice. Many of these policies and actions demean people of color, support hate-filled speech from white supremacists, ostracize gender minorities, demonize refugees and immigrants, and ignore climate change realities. These policies and actions embolden others to act similarly, polarize people within and beyond this nation, falsely cloak nationalism, fascism, and racism in words of universal beliefs and values, distorting and undermining the very bases of many faiths, not the least of which is what it means to be Christ-affirming. Take just a moment and think of a situation in your life where that's quite a list, isn't it? Where it feels like you're aware of, personally, in your own experience, lived experience, or in the lived experience of someone that you know and care about, where one of those categories of oppression is impacting them. Let's take a moment and reflect on that. You may have a long list, I don't know. But think of at least one. I got an email this past week from a trans person that I love very much, talking about some of Trump's policies in this regard within the last few days, and also the Canadian government's withdrawal of certain health supports for that community. There's a for instance, right? As contemplatives of diverse ancestries, traditions, and faiths, we hold in common our witness to love and compassion, the healing of division, promotion and protection of human dignity, and the stewardship of creation. In so holding, we honor and cherish the inherent divinity existing within all of creation. Our intention is to stand in unanimity and nonviolent resistance to the very real threats to that which we hold in common. By the way, holding something in common means that you consciously hold it together with people that you don't like. If you don't have the big definition of in common right from the start on this stuff, it just sort of doesn't work. That's a hard idea. Recognizing that actions of tribalism, fascism, isolationism, and similar divisive initiatives are now happening throughout this world, as citizens of this nation, so again, writing as American citizens, together we seek to provide a common message to reject and resist the policies and actions of our nation and its leaders when they run counter to our common holdings. As contemplatives of diverse faiths, we may and must speak with one voice in this matter today. Silence in the face of evil is itself evil, warned Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act. Precisely because we want to remain faithful to both the divine which we seek to understand and the love which we seek to live, we choose not to be silent. We choose to speak and to act. So that's the preamble to the four statements from the Barman Declaration that we're going to look at together. All right? So again, you won't find all of these equally applicable. Make sure you take the time in your own reflection to get past sentence number one, because often the expansion of that first sentence feels like it broadens the understanding that it's based on, and at least for me, I found that it makes it easier for me to stir my own imagination about my life circumstances and what the application for this might be. All right, so what we'll do is we'll put them up one at a time. I want to give you time to reflect on instances of these matters in your own sphere of influence and to reflect on what nonviolent action or creative third way thinking looks like in the face of what comes to your mind when you reflect on these things. All right? So, long way to do it. I am going to read them out loud, one by one, so that when I edit the podcast, the folks who are listening but not here to see them on the screen will also have the content. All right? We have a common message in this time of common need. To the extent that our government affirms the basic dignity of all people and works deliberately to provide equal access to law, economic opportunity, education, health care, and a healthy environment, we will be loyal citizens. But to the extent it promotes factionalism, racism, fascism, unequal treatment in law enforcement, gender bias, or harm to the poor, the oppressed, the disadvantaged, the unwanted, the refugee, and the environment, we declare that we will nonviolently reject and resist. You can just leave that one up for a bit, Jude, and give people a little bit of time with it, all right? So what we're thinking about is ways in which we encounter those same issues in our own life experience, or ways in which our imagination is engaged with them, perhaps in a global circumstance or a wider circumstance, and what it might look like to respond to those things in a third way, neither despair and passivity nor violence in kind. A security comes not from gun ownership or military might. It does not come from oppression of the many for the enrichment of the few. It does not come from degrading others who are unlike ourselves. As contemplatives of many faiths, we seek the welfare of all our brothers and sisters, including those of differing perspectives and opinions. But to the extent that current policies and actions demand allegiance to the tyranny of the privileged and the few, we declare we will nonviolently reject and resist. We seek to speak the truth in love and to challenge the prevailing ideological and political convictions which do not align with the divinity of love. We understand that free speech, pursuit of happy and healthy living, and freedom of religion lay in the constitutional foundation of this nation's history and in our hopes of securing and protecting the dignity of all humanity. We believe in the full and equal exercise of these rights by all people. To the degree that our leaders shun these rights and their equal exercise, we declare we will nonviolently reject and resist. We embrace separation of the powers of church and state and urge all to continue to embrace it. And while individuals may vote as their conscience dictates, it is blatantly false to proclaim that any elected or appointed leader of this nation, including the president, represents more than a person charged with the duty to serve all of the people of this nation. It is blatantly false to proclaim that they are appointed or especially chosen of God to lead this nation. It is blatantly false to conclude that they are somehow above the constraints of moral and legal scrutiny. To such positions, we declare we will nonviolently reject and resist. I have to confess that, or at least I choose to confess, that when I read that one, I kind of tried to plug our prime minister into that ideological dilemma just a little bit, and I found myself chuckling because the idea that, you know, that Justin is like God's man and above the law doesn't seem to concern us collectively as a nation all that much. We're a little more concerned about how much he did or didn't smoke up before it was legal. Anyways, let's back it up to the first one just for a sec. Now, but you recognize in there, at least I feel like it's reasonable to recognize in there, the news cycle of the day, as well as experiences all around us. So what I want to do, and again, participate as you feel comfortable or inclined, but what I want to do is just back up to these and ask if any particular instances have come to your mind or feel like they resonate with experiences that you've had. So again, don't feel anything you feel uncomfortable sharing. None of what you share will end up on the podcast. Like, I'll edit this entire conversational part out. It just won't be available on the website at all, except to say to the podcast people, as I'm about to do right now, this is what we did together. Find someone and go for coffee and go ahead and do it. The Barman Declaration is easy to find online.